thank you for being here tonight. My name is Charlie McCormick, and I'm the Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs here at Shriner. And on behalf of our President, Dr. Tim Summerlin, and all the faculty and staff and students here at Shriner University, we'd like to welcome you to tonight's Texas Water Symposium. The Texas Water Symposium, especially for those of you who are familiar with these, will remember that we're a partnership between Shriner University, Texas Tech University, the University of Texas at San Antonio, Texas Public Radio, and the Hill Country Alliance. And we regularly hold symposiums around the greater Hill Country to bring the public into contact with a wide variety of experts and politicians and scientists, landowners, and tonight, storytellers about the significance of water. Now, tonight's water symposium is admittedly a departure from the typical water symposium, which focuses on the politics or the science or the economic impact of water in our region. And I'm delighted that joining us on tonight's panel are Dr. David Taylor, visiting assistant professor of sustainability from Stony Brook University, who, as you can see, is with us electronically. Joe Herring Jr., a local businessman, columnist, former mayor, citizen of the year, author, and historian of Kerrville and Kerr County. And Dr. Fred Stevens, a former professor of biology at Shriner and recipient of the prestigious Minnie Stevens Piper Professor Award, which recognizes the outstanding teacher scholars in Texas. We thank them all for sharing their stories with us. And once I sit down, they'll take over and introduce, provide any additional introduction they may want to make, and then move on into the stories. At the end, I'll return to the podium, and we'll have an opportunity for some questions and answers if there are any. So let's start tonight's panel with the assumption first that stories matter. And one of the reasons that they matter so much is that we often take them for granted. It's just a story, people say. How much significance can it really have? And my response, of course, is that stories have a tremendous significance. Stories, I argue, both reveal us and they make us. They reveal us by articulating those things we love and hate, our hopes and our fears, our biases and our prejudices, that we would otherwise hide behind politeness and perhaps proper decorum. We tell things through stories that we otherwise couldn't or wouldn't speak. Now, stories also make us by providing us models on which we shape our lives. They inspire us to do something different or to do nothing different other than that which we currently do. Stories are, in short, powerful. So first tonight, we'll hear from Dr. David Taylor, visiting assistant professor of sustainability from Stony Brook University. David?
All right. So just so y'all know, I recently moved to Long Island from Texas. I'm missing hearing howdy, and I'm missing Texas rivers, and I'm certainly missing the nice winters down there. This is me sitting in the middle of the Brazos about 2 years ago, actually a little bit longer, I'm thinking about rivers about then. But I want to talk particularly about this one song that some of you may know, and it's called Texas River Song. So let me start with a quote from Rick Bass. Bass, in his book Falling from Grace in Texas, says that I would like to make the case for preserving not just the concerns of our flesh, clean air and clean water, for those challenges will be coming with ever-increasing frequency soon enough, but the spirit as well, and of the need, the legacy of the birthright of Texans to have open space for our minds, for imagination, and our sanity, in addition to serving as an anchor and stabilizer upon all our other needs. So let me play you a brief little bit of this song. This is a performance by Townes Van Zandt.
This is a real pretty song. It's called the Texas River Song. It's an old folk song. Well, we crossed the White Pecos, and we forded the New Oasis, and we swam the Guadalupe, and we followed the Brazos. Red River runs rusty, and the Wichita clear, and down on the Brazos I courted my dear. Lolly, lolly, lend me your hand. Lolly, lolly, lend me your hand.
Oh, I'll stop there because that's about as long as people usually can take Townes' voice. But I want to talk a little bit about this chorus and a little bit about the song. So the outline of my talk tonight is going to be about the history and the context of this song. A little bit about Rivers and story, and I think the introduction actually will serve to connect this. And then maybe some broader implications about art and imagination and connection with rivers. So this song has a really interesting history. My mom grew up on the SMS ranch out in Stanford, and she said she heard the cowboys singing it in the 30s. But we know the song dates back much earlier. The first known version of it was titled the Brazos River Song, and it was sung by Irene Carlisle in Arkansas in 1942. She stated that she learned the song in 1921 from a hired man in Texas, but beyond that, we don't know anything for sure about how it was distributed. We know that it was first released in 1952 by the Library of Congress in a collection called Songs of the Mormons and Songs of the West, and it's under the Songs of the West part. In the series Folk Music in United States of the United States, in the liner notes of that album, Duncan Emmerich says of the Brazos River Song that it is a Whitman-esque song which celebrates the names of the rivers of Texas and a most unusual song celebrating the great rivers of Texas, and was evidently created by someone who knew and loved the land and who also loved the names of the land. As far as it becoming more widely known, that's not a problem. That became a bigger part of folk music in Texas. Now, the reality is we don't know who wrote it. There have been a number of attempts trying to find out. I talked with Dr. Hartman a couple of years ago. He offered me a new trail, but frankly, that one's kind of died out in about the mid-19th century. Another critic has offered me the idea that it, with the sort of sound and the chord structure, that it's likely from an Appalachian song and thus a former Scottish ballad. And the Vance Randolph papers in the Arkansas Folkloric Society don't seem to have much else about it, and there's no other recorded kinds of history that he found of this song being performed. Now, I'm going to offer you another version real quickly, and this was Irene Carlisle's version.
We crossed the broad Pecos, we forded the Nueces, we swam the Guadalupe, we followed the Brazos. Red River runs rusty, the Wichita clear, but down by the Brazos I courted my dear. Then lie, 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 lee, 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 pull the boat on. Lie, 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 lee, 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 pull the boat on. Lie, 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 lee, 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 pull the boat on. My Brazos River sweetheart has left me and gone.
So I'll stop there because her voice isn't all that much better than Townes's. But in the traditional version of this, the lyrics go along these lines. You'll see that in different variations of the song that the chorus is the one that changes. Sometimes it will go with there's many a river that waters the land. In Townes' version and in other versions, they'll say, you know, what is it? The Trinity's muddy and the Brazos quicksand. The typical kinds of verses, though, are pretty standard and don't seem to change very often. They list 14 rivers listed in Texas. The song is sung under different titles. The original one, which is the Brazos River Song, the River Brazos, Down by the Brazos, the Rivers of Texas. There's many a river, but most often now it's performed under Texas River Song. It's been recorded many, many, many times. This is just one of the discographies that I've found from 2007. But we know it's performed far more often, and it's covered often by Texas and other folk singers. The more notable versions recently are John Lomax Jr. Noted it in Singing Texas, edited by Abernathy. But if you look at this version, it's a very interesting version. The song, the lyrics and the chorus are dramatically different than the ones most commonly sung. I played you Townes' version, which is the one that I kind of learned when I was a little bit younger. And then more recently, Lyle Lovett put it into his two CD set called Step Inside This House, sort of recording a lot of the musicians that influenced him. Again, basically every Texas folk musician knows this song. It's sung and shared among others. What's interesting about this song is other states like it. And so what they do is they take the 14 river names and they stick their rivers in it. And so while the sort of storyline goes is that, you know, this girl dumps this guy by the river, they'll find 14 rivers, which I found was interesting that New Jersey could figure out they had 14 rivers to list, but they did it. And so sure enough, there's these versions, and I've actually heard tell that there's three other states that have a version, but I hadn't really been able to trace them. I've actually found the lyrics for each of these. When you look at the song, it's an interesting song. It basically tries to show this connection between the singer and a woman. And from what you can tell, it's not a good relationship, because whatever happens is the singer, the young man, gets left by the river. But then, of course, he moves on to other rivers, finding other possible partners. Abernathy writes of the song's narrative that one Texas rambling man met his match in a young lady who lived somewhere along the 840 miles of the Brazos, and that he had crossed all these rivers except those in the Panhandle, and his education was brought into sharp focus down by the Brazos. If he was a roving gambler, it served him right. I have no idea why Abernathy said he might have been a roving gambler. There's no evidence for that. But, you know, relationships gone wrong by rivers in Texas is not a news story. So this sort of, the sort of legend on the far left doesn't actually work out real well. But if you look at the groupings of the rivers, it's a kind of interesting idea when we begin to look at the song. It starts off with, well, we crossed the wide Pecos and forded the Nueces. We swam the Guadalupe and we paddled the Brazos. The Red River runs rusty in the Wichita clear, and down on the Brazos I courted my dear. And so when you go through this traditional narrative, you begin to see that the verses actually are an eastward movement. And this is a kind of odd idea when we begin to think that this is a song that, as far as we know, has always been sung in English. And it's showing eastward movement and eastward migration, not what we would think of as typical kind of 19th century westward migration, right? And so it's kind of interesting when we look at this idea, because one reading suggests that the eastward migration would predate Anglo settlement, right, with Stephen F. Austin, that he was left alone by the Brazos and then finds girls by the score at the Natchez, leads one to believe that the story predates Anglo settlement. But my problem with that argument is then wouldn't it be in Spanish? And so I've never really figured that one out. I kind of struggle with that one. None of the above, none of the people who've written about this really say too much about the song's need to list. The descriptions of the rivers and the listeners are reminded that there's many a river that waters the land. So here's where I'm going to take a kind of different angle on all of this, and I hope y'all can bear with me a little bit as I kind of make an odd leap at this point in the discussion. So let me turn to some writers. So when I look at stories and music and about rivers, I tend to see three themes coming up again and again. First is a notion of focus, that when you're on the river, people seem to know these things, that they know how to tell what's special. They know what to look for, that you have to have a level of focus when you engage in a river, Rick Bass says in his essay, River People. That as Graves writes in Goodbye to a River, that rivers become a place of immersion. And again, I grew up fundamental independent Baptist, so it also is a baptism. It becomes a way to be connected. And being immersed into this, it changes your sense of connections to other things, and you become more deeply connected. And then as I write in one essay I published when I was giving a longer lecture and spending a couple of days on the rivers in South Carolina. I wrote that it takes time to lose yourself to the flow of a river until you can lean back in your kayak and stretch your legs out to both sides, keeping perfect balance because you've found your comfort and connection to the boat's movement, letting the sun wash your neck and face, the herons and egrets staring stick still as you drift by, the feral domestic ducks clicking their bills near the boat, the creaking oak limbs in a spring wind, the sound of water over rocks becoming melody. So when we think about this as rivers and stories and telling this story, these three ideas of focus, immersion, and blending seem to me to then to become, writing a river is sort of singing the river. It's connecting to the melody of that river. And in the song, you see this where the rivers become this kind of focal point of how the narrator begins to look at his relationships, gets lost by it, and then kind of keeps moving on as a way of kind of engaging in these places and in these rivers as a way of reconciling his own sense of place and a kind of celebration in the listing. So, as I would say, maybe in this way, in the song, that the rivers begin to sing our stories too. That really what happens in this piece is you see that the sort of listing of the rivers and this sort of movement by the narrator is a way that he begins to deeply connect with the place, even though his relationship seemed to go badly. He constantly is looking at this kind of connection. And then when we look at the legacy of the song, why do we keep singing it? Because it's this beautiful list of Texas rivers. It's this sort of back and back again and again that kind of allows it a strange way of allowing us to celebrate it indirectly. So in another longer piece, I wrote that this something about art, imagination, and connection. But I wanted to make sure kind of you're seeing how I'm trying to make this leap between the history of the song to this idea of art, place, and rivers. So as I say, that art can be a creative, playful engagement of a feeling, moment, scene, concept, or cultural past. In other words, art has a broad array of purposes and may no more be restricted to the arena of intellectuals than for the purposes of public relations. It seeps between cracks in our definitions when we try to name it with too restrictive of a word, image, song, scene, or sound. When we consider the possibility of art as also having a playful application to place and community, then maybe something arises of our reimagining our sort of ecological home, house, river, and dwelling, and the relationships between people, place, critters, stresses, and others. Art might then evoke a community's history, stories, and values, and these expressions may then reflect what it is that binds us, and in this case, Texas and rivers, and place into a broader community. So, you know, I'm often asked this, who wrote the song? And I've really come to the realization for me is, well, we did. We've been writing it all along. We sing it over and over. Other states are picking it up to sing it for them too. And it's this interesting thing of, you know, maybe the rivers are a part of it. Because if we go back to what Rick Bass said at the sort of beginning quote, you see that he's saying that in these connections, that what he's wanting to preserve is the spirit. And it's this spirit in the listing of the rivers. It's this history and connection of this song being passed on again and again as an oral tradition that's binding and connecting us to the rivers. And in many ways, the rivers reminding us of what we value and what it is that we, that serves as our anchor and stabilizer upon all our other needs. So when I'm often talk about this river, this song, I really want to sort of pass on to people that it's a really fascinating and unique cultural history in this song that, you know, for a land that's pretty dry generally, it's actually this song, perhaps our greatest folk song, is the one that actually reminds us of the waters and the rivers in our state. So that's my presentation. So look forward to listening to the others.
Welcome tonight. I think I drew the bean to go second. Stevens will do the cleanup. Very thankful to be here. Thank you for the invitation, Charlie. I appreciate it. Found out something about Dr. Taylor that I share. My mother was also raised in Stanford. Fred and I are friends on Facebook, and I've admired his photos of a canoe that he made himself and that I've coveted for many months. Charlie introduced me as a historian, and I'm not a historian. I'm more like a collector, really. What I largely collect are photographs. Like photographs and stories. And I've brought some photographs to share with you that'll come up later. But I wanted to make that distinction, especially here. I've spoken many times actually in this room. This is the first time I've actually gotten to speak about the river. Most of this, of my collection focuses on the Texas Hill Country and centers on Kerrville and Kerr County. But what I think is common with the stories of Kerr County and its river are common water stories in the Texas Hill Country. They're stories of settlers, both recent and prehistoric. There's stories of mills and dams. There's stories of floods, stories of camps, and there's stories of recreation, however improbable. Some of you know that Kerrville was founded here because of the Guadalupe River. Often I'll take visiting groups to the bluff overlooking Louise Hayes Park, where the nice new pavilion is, and I'll ask the groups, why do you think they came here? And they'll look at the river and they'll say, well, it's the river. It's they must have used it for water and for power. And the real reason is they came because of the cypress trees. The man who founded Kerrville was a man named Joshua Brown, shingle maker. And it was his idea to work all day and all night and rain and wind and cold and haul shingles from here to the nearest market in San Antonio past obstacles like Big Joshua Hill and Native American tribes. And for all that work, he would hope to make $10 or $15. He made his first shingle camp here in 1846. And if these windows were open and you looked out, you could actually see where his first shingle camp was. It's interesting because he used a camp that was already there and had actually been there for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. That camp did not last very long. Evidently, the people who had been using it recently did not approve of his arrival. And he left. He left and came back in 1848. His second camp was in what became downtown Kerrville. Native Americans actually lived on these rivers and creeks for thousands of years. In fact, Clovis points have been found here. Clovis points date to the last ice age, so about 10,000 years ago. 10,000 years is too big a number for me, so I like to think in average generations, that's about 500 generations ago. Those people didn't build settlements in which they lived year-round, but they came here over and over and over again, and they visited the same place. My family owns property in downtown Kerrville, which is one of those campsites. We found all sorts of we haven't, but an archaeological team has found all sorts of artifacts there, including some Montel points. So people have been camping in the downtown Kerrville area for at least 3,000 years. When the settlers came, and if someone wanted to queue up those photographs that I brought, that'd be awesome. That's available. When the settlers came, one of the first things they would do is build, They would build dams and mills. They would try to harness the river. One of the first mills built in Kerrville was built by Christian Dietert in 1857. Kerrville people will recognize the name Dietert. It's a famous name here. We have the Dietert Center is a famous senior citizen center here. Excuse me. Traces of Dietert's mill that he built in 1857 are still visible on the river, and sad to see it crumble so, but that was one of the early things in Kerrville that tied us to the river. Another thing that tied us to the river and brought so many photographs to my collection were floods. You know, in the early days, it was expensive to take photographs. But if there was a flood or a parade or a snowstorm, people got out their cameras. Most of our floods usually occur in July. So don't camp next to the river in July. Occurred 1889, 1900, 1901, 1932, 1935, 1978, 1987, and 2002. This past June, during the horrible floods that were on the Blanco River and just to the east of us, the heavy drops were falling on the roof, and my wife Carolyn said, "Should I be worried?" I said, "No, our floods only happen in July," which she me for later. Another thing that about our rivers that have been so popular in this area and in other hill country areas are our camps, our summer camps for children. The first summer camp for children in our area was in 1921, Camp Rio Vista. In 1924, Camp Stewart. In 1926, we got camps for girls. We got Camp Stewart for girls, which is now called Camp Mystic, and then Camp Waldemar. Lastly, recreation, however improbable. And I'm not going to talk about that until I show you some pictures. So let me go through these first. This is what I remember of the river, although this is well before I was a child. We played in the river all of the time. My parents had a print shop right in the downtown Kerrville. They didn't want us around those scary machines. So we were free-range kids, and we free-ranged right to the river where we were not supposed to be. Early on, the settlers would build dams. This is a Cypress Dam. I don't think this is the dam downtown. I think this is actually near Methodist Encampment. It washed away in the 32 flood. This is a picture of the 32 flood taken from the Blue Bonnet Hotel in downtown Kerrville. The water is coming from Hunt, and the area on the left part of the flood is what is now Louise Hayes Park. For those who remember, the Cascade Pool is shown at the bottom. This is another picture of the 1932 flood, which was taken about maybe football fields that way. This was taken very near Shriner University. Another picture of the 32 flood. Now this is another one. This is the 1935 flood. And the area which would become Louise Hayes Park is completely inundated. Recreation. People love coming to our rivers to swim. This is a picture of the Lakeside Park, which was about where G Street is, between G Street and D Street in Kerrville, Texas. It's weird. I've gone to the site, and that water is about 7 inches deep now. So I'm guessing there was once a dam that is now gone. Another view of Lakeside Park. And then, of course, the camps. This is Camp Mystic, beautiful girls in canoes. Look at those canoes, Fred. What do you think? This is Waldemar. And then Mills. This was Mill was actually in downtown Kerrville. It's the Charles Shriner Mill. And this is a view from the riverside. The long ditch carved into the limestone rock is still there today. The little archway by the wood structure is also still there today. And the structure underneath the wheel is still there today. This is the view of the Mill Dam. That was probably about 1900, 1905. Then, recreation, however improbable. Few people will believe, but we used to have water ski shows in downtown Kerrville, complete with beautiful girls on water skis. They skied at night as well. But this is a view from the bridge. And the lake formed by that dam in downtown Kerrville is still as small as it was then, and they would ski there. This is looking upriver, coming down the river. Funny story, I've actually been in a boat with skiers because my mom and dad were avid skiers when I was little. I remember hanging on to that boat just going, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. And this is the bridge in downtown Kerrville and the spectator bleachers for those shows. I go back to the picture of the kids. You know, those are my memories of our river here. But water in the form of our river, the Guadalupe, is the ribbon that flows through the story of our community and the communities of the Texas Hill Country. And I'm thankful that my boyhood, I got to spend part of it on the river. Brett, thank you.
I didn't grow up in Kerrville. I grew up in Wisconsin, and in 1973 moved to Texas to go to graduate school. And in 1977 moved to Kerrville, where I've lived ever since. But in thinking about what I might write about, my connection with Texas waters, I realized that my connection with water in Texas really goes way back. And so I've written up just a little story that I'll read to you that I think summarizes that personal history and those connections. I call this Running to Get Away. Because my grandfather was a construction foreman who followed large construction projects, he was working on a dam on the Devil's River near Del Rio, Texas, in 1928 when my father was born. 2 years later, the family returned, and Dad's younger brother Tom was born there too. Grandpa was a prolific storyteller. One of his anecdotes about the nature of flooding is about the nature of flooding in Central Texas. His comment was, quote, "When it floods, one has to run to get away." I thought he was exaggerating. He was not. The Stevens family always returned to Wisconsin from the many sites where my grandfather worked. I was raised in Wisconsin, but was long aware that my dad was a native-born Texan. It seemed like a simple, isolated quirk in family history. That fact, and the fact that my 100% German grandmother could make some fine tamales. She learned how on the banks of the Devils. Then in college, I developed a strong interest in studying freshwater fish. An advisor recommended that I consider graduate work in Texas. I ended up heading to Texas mostly because of the chance to work with Clark, renowned expert on Texas fishes. Clark spent much of his life wading into the streams and rivers of Texas in pursuit of various species of freshwater fish. The opportunity to study under Clark was of singular importance in my professional life. I could not have asked for a better nor a more influential mentor. While in graduate school, I passed through Del Rio for the first time. I was curious. What had happened to those dams my grandfather had helped to build on the Devil's River? I obtained a map of the area, which revealed a large reservoir on the Rio Grande, which backed up water burying the lower sections of the Devils. Clearly marked on the map were those Devil's River dams. They were now effectively reefs on the bottom of Lake Amistad. When Lake Amistad was flooded in the late 60s, Clark personally rescued the last living individuals of a spring-adapted species of live-bearing fish from the rising waters. I've spent considerable time in pursuit of the finny denizens of Central Texas waters. In spite of Texas' reputation for being water poor, it is home to a considerable variety of freshwater fish species. The experts say that there are 693 species now residing in the state. Of these, 110 are in the Guadalupe River Basin and 60 in Kerr County alone. Some are visitors brought in by humans, such as smallmouth bass, rainbow trout, and red-bellied sunfish. Others are widely distributed species which happen to include Texas within their ranges. Examples are the sand shiner, blacktail shiner, bluegill sunfish, and largemouth bass. So others are specialties found largely or entirely within the state. These include the Texas shiner, large-scale log perch, and the Guadalupe bass. The realities that these fish live with include the fact that in Texas, one might think that there are really only two seasons, drought season and flood season. The emphasis is on drought season, but much of the drama comes with flood season. Now I've lived nearly all of my adult life in the Guadalupe River Valley. I regularly walk Kerrville's River Trail and gaze upon the gentle riffles of the Guadalupe. Then I look high into the treetops and see the logs jammed there high above the river, and I am reminded then that, quote, "When it floods, one has to run to get away."
My thanks to all of tonight's storytellers, and I think we have a little time here for some questions. We're going to get the microphones ready so that if you have any question, we can pick that up on tape. This one hot? Okay. And we'll ask our panelists to use the microphone too. Of course, David, we've got you mic'd into the room so we can hear you as well. David, let me start off with one question for you before we open it up to the audience. You've talked about this power of Texas rivers. Have you seen that there are other perhaps natural phenomena that emerge in folks' songs, folks' stories that have as much symbolic power as the river does, or is there something unique about the river?
This is something where, in Texas, I think it often comes out in folk songs, more about cattle drives and work. But when I look over folk songs that really deal with natural phenomena, this song kind of is somewhat unique. It really is the only one that I know that deals with a large, area. And is focusing on, again, the kinds of things which the other speakers have pointed out are very much about flood, very much about drought, and they certainly impact our lives in a very immediate way. Those are the ones that I tend to think of. I mean, obviously, you can go back and look at Woody Guthrie's Dust Bowl ballads, which are really, about the phenomenon of the Dust Bowl. But that's kind of a practice of mismanagement of land, not so much natural phenomena.
Thank you, David.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll open it up to the audience now. Anyone have any questions?
My name is Weir Labatt, and my grandparents' house was on Water Street and backed up to the river. And we never were really allowed to go down on the river, at least we weren't supposed to. And there was no improvements on the river. All of the houses along Water Street were faced north, and the river wasn't considered that necessarily an asset. Do any of you all know why that was?
My family's print shop is right down the street from your grandparents' house and your great-grandparents' house. And we were not allowed to go to the river either. So. If my mom is listening to this, we did not go to the river. But that's been the history of our community for a long time, facing away from the river. And I think over the last 20 years, we've seen a lot more facing toward the river. The island, Tranquility Island, which is now part of a beautiful trail system, when I was a boy, was just a wild place where snakes and turtles lived and boys who were not supposed to be there were. And I don't know why, in the era of your great-grandparents, grandparents, my parents, that everybody faced toward the street. It may have been commerce. It may have been that they were worried of the cleanliness of the river. I don't know. But it was a wonderful place, a wonderful classroom to grow up in.
I'd just like to comment to that I've had an answer given to me in the past, and I'm not going to be politically correct today probably, but not known for that anyway. The settlement, or where the Afro-American community lived, was upstream. Founding fathers and people in Kerrville refused to put in a sewer system to hook up that way. And so as a result, the sewage flowed into the river, and the river was pretty much off limits because of that reason.
Not to contradict, but many of my photographs in my collection show people enjoying the river in our neck of the woods, in our downtown Kerrville area. It may not have been as clean as it should have been, I agree. But I do have I have photographic evidence that people from the late 1800s on enjoyed spending time in the river. Now, most of them were in boats in the photographs, but there are a few bathers, like the children playing in the dam right there by Earl Garrett Street.
I'm really curious. I've known a lot of water people through my career, and it's always an interesting story. Regardless of what your profession is, When did you get hooked, and why did you get hooked that water has become an element of your career?
Guess I'll answer that. Is this
sure, Fred? Go ahead.
You know, when I was probably 12 or 13, I was hooked on recreational fishing, and really, that was my hook that started it. And my family started camping and regularly vacationing, where we still do, actually, in Wisconsin. And I think a turning point came one summer when I got curious about the structure of the lake, the whole summer mapping it instead of fishing it. So somewhere in there, I think the transition went where that led me to aquatic sciences and fisheries biology. But I think it actually started out as an interest in recreation.
David, would you like to answer that too?
Sure. So I grew up in Lewisville, Texas. So I'm a fight farmer. My parents, our house was right below the Lake Lewisville Dam. And so the Elm Fork of the Trinity was no more than a half a mile from the house. And since it's a Corps of Engineer floodplain land, it was never developed. So it was a place for me to go. And as, you know, many kids in the 60s and 70s, my parents would lock me out of the house because they didn't want me, as my mom said, to burn down the house. So I would spend my summers wandering up and down the Elm Fork in that undeveloped land fishing. And really, again, it was formative to me. And then to my mind, since my kind of context is about sustainability and environmental engagement, but to me, it's always that I realized that the rivers that I would walk near and the way that I connected with them, it was for me through story. And so listening to my dad's stories about the Brazos, and then my own stories and the history of the Elm Fork as it sort of wound its way through, you know, Denton down to Lewisville and to Dallas. These were really powerful stories to me. And then to see them, because if we're Texans, we know we're also all affected by reservoirs, that between the reservoirs and the rivers in between these, that somehow there were really fascinating stories being connecting to me. And I can honestly say that little spot of land is the reason I do what I do, that between my dad's teaching me how to tell stories and my own connection to that place, that's really where it shaped my career.
Joe, anything to add other than your misspent youth splashing around in the river?
I guess my earliest interest in local history came from those times along the river, because there were the old mill had an ice house, which by the time I was a child was abandoned, which meant we would have to explore it. And there were tunnels that went under the city of Kerrville. So, and the A.C. Schreiner home, your great-grandparents' home, the only other child my age in the downtown area lived there. And so we spent a lot of time in that house, and it was a very historic and beautiful house. So I think a lot of my love of history came from wandering up and down the Guadalupe River.
I was just curious whether the professor had a favorite song about Texas rivers, and if so, could he sing us a bar or two?
Oh, I don't know about that. There are folks. Matter of fact, Kathleen Hudson, get her. She, you know, she's at Schreiner. She knows a heck of a lot more about music and has a way better voice. There are a few other songs that mention the Brazos, and then actually, not surprisingly, East Texas has quite a few songs that sort of connect some of the river, kind of ecology and the communities that were deeply connected to those. So I'll pass on the singing, but I do want to pass on one other thing that in 1980, when I finished high school in Lewisville, I had the really good luck of teaching tennis at Camp Rio Vista. And I came down there as an 18-year-old, and I saw the most beautiful river I'd ever seen, because all I had ever seen was the muddy old Trinity. And I went, holy crud, no wonder people want to live here. So I loved it down there that year. It was really important for me. That was a great summer.
All right. Well, join me once again. Thank all of our panelists this evening. thank you for your attendance at this Texas Water Symposium, and we look to, forward to seeing you at our next event. Thank you very much, and have a great evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.